Dan Handelman, Portland Cop Watch, thank you so much once again for joining me. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Coming up, Fight the Empire with Per Fogring. You've been listening on 90.7 FM on our great big Eiffel Tower on the hill and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel in Portland. Bonds Over Borders is a benefit for Innovation Law Lab, a Portland-based organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants at detention centers, both locally and around the country. There will be live stand-up sets from Adam Passy and Dan Weber and live music by Pedro Queriega. Again, that's Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel, 403 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Brunch Box, featuring breakfast, burgers, beer, and more daily. From 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., serving Portland at 620 Southwest 9th Avenue downtown and their new location at 676 Southeast Morrison Street. More information is available online at brunchboxpdx.com. And now it's time for Fight the Empire with Per Fogring.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogring, and the show is Fight the Empire. And I have a guest today. It's Dave Lindorf, who's an investigative reporter, longtime reporter, and he writes for Counterpunch, The Nation, and Salon, among other publications. And he has a website called This Can't Be Happening. And his latest article in Counterpunch is about remembering some atomic spies who we ought to talk about some more. Dave Lindorf, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, this is the atomics. These atomic spies, I remember them from way back in the old days, but a lot of people, you know, probably never heard of them. So tell us about them.
Yeah, well, Ted Hall hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, Ted Hall is a really interesting character. He was there were two spies basically who gave significant, I mean, drawings, detailed descriptions of the atomic bomb to the Russians. One was Klaus Fuchs, who pleaded guilty in 1950 in England. And also was spying on the hydrogen bomb and served a lot of time and then ended up going to East Germany after he got out. He was a committed communist from Germany who fled Hitler and then joined the bomb project. The other one, and he's well known, there's been a movie about him and stuff, but the other one, Ted Hall, was not a communist, was not recruited by the NKGB, Russia's spying agency, was not connected to any other spies at Los Alamos, but simply decided as a young man working, the youngest scientist on the Manhattan Project, decided towards the end of 1944, the year he started working there, at the age of 18, I might add, that the idea of the U.S. coming out of World War II with a monopoly on the bomb would be a disaster for Russia and for a lot of the world, because the U.S. would use it and use it to dominate the rest of the world. So anyway, he gave them in a sort of a it's really funny. He actually, in a kind of a Woody Allen-esque take the money and run, you know, scenario, he and his roommate from Harvard, during a visit Ted made to his parents in New York, ran around trying to find a Soviet intelligence agent to give the plans to, and he ended up you know, getting turned away at the U.S. Communist Party headquarters. He ended up getting turned away at the or his roommate did, at the Russian consulate in New York. They all thought it was a setup, you know, by maybe the FBI, and turned him away. But he finally ran into a Soviet intelligence agency guy at AMTORG, which was the Russian trading agency in New York, you know, for buying and selling stuff to the U.S. And that guy recognized, knew enough about nuclear stuff to recognize that what Ted had was the real deal, and passed it on. And after that, he was connected up with someone, with a Russian agent, so he could get his stuff to them, you know, a courier. But he never was caught. This is the fascinating thing, and it's why nobody knows about him. He was picked up by two FBI agents in 1950, when you know, around the time the Rosenbergs were arrested, and it was because they recognized a name that was written wrong but turned out to be Ted in the Venona transcripts, which were secret coded messages sent by Russian spies to Moscow and back, and the precursor to the NSA had people working on that for years trying to decipher them. It was a very clever pre-computer code, but they finally got it, and they were gradually, it was a very hard thing to work out. It wasn't like you found the book and you knew the code. So they were gradually translating these things, and they did find a reference to Ted. So they questioned him, and he totally denied everything. And between his denials and the fact that they had nothing on him except the transcripts, they didn't bust him then, because they didn't want the Russians to know they'd broken the code. So he was left alone, and then they kind of dropped him. And so, he, you know, he went through life worrying, and his wife, Joan, worrying that he would be caught, and maybe executed as a traitor, because he was an American-born guy. But he never did get busted, and he died in 99 in England. They moved to England in 1962, where he headed up research at the Cavendish Lab into nuclear biophysics, he shifted to, and became quite prominent in that field. He died of kidney cancer that he probably contracted from the work he was doing on the bomb at Los Alamos as a young man.
Well, now,
amazing story.
Yeah, but, you know, this goes beyond just mere treasonous behavior, spying. I mean, they, in a way, they Fuchs and Ted Hall, they saved the world from a greater danger. So tell us about
that.
Well,
this was, yeah, well, this was my point in getting interested in Ted. I read a little about him. You can look him up and you can find stuff on him. It just doesn't kind of go anywhere because he didn't get arrested. And so I was fascinated with the fact that he gave critical information about the implosion device of the plutonium bomb. That was the complicated one. You know, the uranium bomb was like a cannon. You fired one half of the hemisphere of the core at the other half with a powerful blast, and it was a long, thin bomb because it was like a cannon barrel, and you fired that, and the bomb blew up. The only problem with the uranium bomb was that you had to refine all that U-235, which is a tiny fraction of uranium ore, in order to get the critical mass of uranium. And plutonium, which is a byproduct of nuclear reactors, is fairly easy to extract. It's a chemical reaction you need to separate it. It's a non-natural element that's a result of chain reaction fission. So, but the problem with it is it was a very unstable element. It did not... it was hard to calculate its critical mass. It had impurities that made it risky to get close to criticality because it could still go critical too early because of the impurities. And so they came up with the idea of having 32 pieces of it that would fit together if they were fit together perfectly by being blasted toward the center by a whole series of simultaneous detonations of an explosive like TNT, you could create a nuclear blast like a uranium bomb. And he was working on getting that those 32 parts to hit simultaneously, because if it wasn't perfect, you didn't get this huge nuclear explosion. You only got what they called a fizzle, which was nothing. So he was blowing these things up over and over again, hiding in a little wooden hut, and not using plutonium, but using another element that would show the symmetricity of the neutron radiation resulting from the blast and see whether it was symmetrical without going critical. So all he was, what he was getting was all kinds of dust from the explosions, but not, a nuclear blast. And he invented a device that would instantly measure the neutron blast before it was destroyed by the explosion, so that he could get readings of how symmetrical the neutron radiation was. And ultimately, he managed to create a setup that worked and gave a symmetric blast, and then they blew up the Trinity bomb using that technique and knew that they had it. So that was a bomb that was used on Nagasaki. It was actually a more powerful bomb than the uranium bomb.
Well, I guess what it comes down to, though, is that for a number of years after World War II, the U.S. had a monopoly on the atomic bomb, and what was the U.S. going to do with it?
Well, here's the thing, is I realized that Ted was right, because I read this book a couple of years ago by Michio Kaku, the astrophysicist that people see a lot on network TV, gets called in to comment on everything from earthquakes to
nuclear war. Pacifica, too, I think.
Pardon?
I think he's on Pacifica, too.
Yeah, I think that's true. Mm. And he and another nuclear physicist named Daniel Axelrod, who lives retired now from University of Michigan and lives out in a valley in Northern California, wrote this book called To Win a Nuclear War, The Pentagon's Secret Nuclear War Plans. That book, which was very well researched and based on and it published in 1987. It was very well researched, and it was based on documents released by the National Security Council and by Pentagon strategists dating back to the 1940s and early 50s, which showed that the U.S. was developing these plans even before the end of World War II to bomb and destroy the Soviet Union so that it would not be able to create a bomb. They figured that, the Russia had these really bright scientists, including Nobelists, like Andrei Sakharov, who were, quite capable of figuring out a nuclear bomb, but they didn't have all the resources that the Manhattan Project got. Russia was fully engaged in a survival battle against the Nazis, crack troops on the Eastern Front all through the war, and they didn't have the resources to devote to this crackpot idea of developing an atomic bomb. But the U.S. did. We poured the equivalent of the Moon program in real dollars into the Manhattan Project to get the bomb. And so, they And they didn't have the, you know, because the U.S. had Hanford, you know, with these cyclotrons and stuff that they were making, and they were capable of really producing a lot of uranium-235 gradually. They got to that point. The Russians weren't even close to doing that, and they didn't have any uranium mines. So, you know, it was a really unfair competition. And Hall's information and also Fuchs's information did was show the Russians that they should not work on a uranium bomb, because they wouldn't be able to get the material they needed to do it. And it showed them how to do the tricky problems. They had already solved at Manhattan Project the tricky problems of dealing with plutonium. So when Fuchs and Hall gave their information separately, the Russians, who had been a little skeptical of Fuchs because he was a German, and they thought he might be a shill, you know, trying to steer them in a wrong direction, dead end. When they got the second information that was the same from Hall, who their agents knew was totally unconnected to Fuchs, and they were giving the same information, they became very confident that it was right, and they basically shifted their whole, I learned this, they shifted their, this wasn't in Kaku's book, this was in my own research, they shifted their program totally into all the resources going into doing the plutonium bomb. And the bomb they produced, which they exploded in August 29th, 1949, was almost carbon copy of the Fukushima Nagasaki Fat Man plutonium bomb. So, you know, you're looking at all that, and you look at the information in Kaku and Axelrod's book, which had all these plans. The one that was going to really happen was in 1949, called Operation Drop Shot, and the reason was that, you know, Truman asked for this planning to present him with a plan for wiping out Russia's industrial base with nuclear weapons. And the Pentagon said, their planners said, we need 300 bombs. And Truman was exasperated. He kept asking, how many bombs have we got? This is after the war, right? I mean, there wasn't any other reason to be asking. We weren't at war with anybody. And he kept saying, how many bombs do we got? How many bombs do we got? And they told him at one point he said, do we have 16 bombs? And they said, no, we only have two. at the end of 1945, there were two bombs that they'd managed to make after blowing up two. And it was a very slow grind. You know, they were basically hand-making these things at Los Alamos. And slowly, the Pentagon said, we need 300 of these bombs. And they, they track, Kaku and Axelrod track how many bombs there were going along the calendar. And at late 1948, December 1948, they had 123 bombs. And that wasn't close to the 300 that the Pentagon said they would need. So, you know, it kept going up and up, and they got by August 1st of 1949, there were, I think, if I remember right, like 200-something, 220. And they were pretty confident that at the rate things were going, it was accelerating, that the construction of these bombs was accelerating, that they would have 300 by December, end of December of 49. So that was kind of the target date. And the other thing they were doing was, in a crash program, was building these new B-36 bombers, which were long-range bombers that could carry these bombs and fly really high and, you know, go over Russia. They needed more than 300, because they had to have decoys, because they knew the Russians would have missiles, but planes, fighter planes that could go up to that altitude and take out these bombers. So they were frantically building these bombers, and they were frantically building the bombs. So clearly they had a plan. you know. And then the Russians blew off their bomb, and it was a total shock to American scientists and strategists when the Russians blew off that bomb in 49 in August, because they thought it would take the Russians at least 10 years to get a bomb because of their, you know, their decimated infrastructure from the war and their lack of funds, not because of their lack of scientific ability, but so they were in shock, and I think rightly so, because they hadn't yet broken the Russian spy ring and seen how successful they were, and they had no idea what Ted had done, or even Fuchs. Fuchs confessed in 1950. So they were really caught flat-footed, and then when they blew off the bomb, Truman called off the effort.
Let's look at the timeline here. So way back in 1945, before the war was even over, and the Soviet Union was our ally against Germany.
Exactly. I mean, you want to talk about treachery. They were already talking about wiping them out. In fact, you know, Churchill came to Roosevelt and proposed that the war just shift against Russia as soon as it was over in Germany. He wanted, he had something he called it Operation Inconceivable, which was a good name for it. He called for turning American and British and, you know, Allied forces on Russia as soon as Germany was defeated, and also rearming 100,000 Wehrmacht troops to join in the effort to go into Russia again. And, you know, it would have been a pretty smart idea if you're thinking of defeating Russia, because their troops had just battled their way all the way to Berlin and were strung out. Their supply lines were really strung out. They were all, you know, battered and worn out themselves, starving. You know, they weren't well supplied. Better equipped and supplied Allied troops, plus the Wehrmacht, who'd probably be really, you know, gung-ho about attacking the Russians, were to attack them at that point in a total betrayal, who knows what would have happened.
Well, you know, Churchill was a guy who said way back when, you wanted to strangle the Bolshevik baby in its crib. And then there were a lot of people think that the real meaning of Munich was that that Chamberlain was trying to get Hitler to go to war against the Soviet Union.
Yeah, well, don't forget the United mm-hmm. States sent 30,000 Marines to fight with the White Russians in an effort, along with Britain and France and other Allied powers, in the Russian Civil War. So, you know, from the beginning, the U.S. has wanted to destroy the communist government there, as it later tried to do in Cuba and other places like Chile when there's been a leftist government, but especially Russia. And, you know, this was being discussed. Roosevelt didn't buy into Churchill's plan when it was presented at the end of, you know, when Germany surrendered in May, because he felt that the U.S. should be focusing on Japan still, you know, which hadn't been defeated. And so, but, you know, Churchill knew about the atom bomb, and it hadn't been blown up yet, but he was hoping it would be, and they were getting close, so he was figuring that could be in the mix, you know, in an attack on Russia. You know, as it happened, after they dropped the two bombs on Japan, the U.S. didn't have any more until December. But, you mm-hmm. know, they shot their wad, basically. But, you know, the point was that all of this goes to, you know, my point, you know, that first of all, the U.S. dropping the bomb on Japan, which we're all told was to end the war and save American lives. And sometimes they'll even say, you know, to save Japanese lives, because so many would die in a U.S., you know, house-to-house battle through Japan. But the reality was that Japan was already toast by August. You know, they didn't have a navy, they didn't have an air force. The U.S. was flying milk runs by B-29s and just dropping tons mm-hmm. and tons of incendiary.
Well, we wanted to show the Soviets what we had.
Exactly, and I would argue that, you know, the 1-2 punch of, you know, the 6th and then the 9th, two nuclear bombs dropped on cities that had really no military significance was mainly because they wanted to get a chance to test both the bombs. They hadn't tested the uranium bomb mm-hmm. yet, which is the one they dropped on Hiroshima first. And then they had the second one to drop and see what it could do, you know, and to show the Russians.
So we got about 3 minutes left. So to kind of sum this all up, for several years after the war ended, well, the U.S. had this plan to actually inflict atomic war on the Soviet Union, destroy all their cities, but they never had, they had to get enough bombs to make it work. And they kept, adding to their bomb stockpile, and the targets kept increasing also. And before we could actually do it, these two spies gave the Soviets the secret so that they could build their own bomb. So in a sense, they were, these two guys who were reviled as traitors were saving the world from kind of a nuclear holocaust. Is that a fair way of putting it?
And let's point out that, first of all, there was no purpose in having 300 bombs if Russia wasn't going to have the bomb for 10 years, right? I mean, unless you're planning on using them, there wasn't anybody else to fight. And so this clearly they were being built for a purpose. The other thing I think is important to note, that we're always told that the Russians... Well, wait, I have another point I want to make first, if we're short. They didn't just do that. They gave us 74 years and counting of no nuclear bomb being used in war because of the mutually assured destruction that Russia getting the bomb represented. And beyond that, someone pointed out to me, they also meant that we haven't had another world war, because no nuclear power is going to attack another nuclear power, or no non-nuclear power is going to attack a nuclear power, because it'll so quickly devolve into a nuclear conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a long stretch of no major war.
It is. So what's the name of this book again, if people want to look it up?
To Win a Nuclear War is the Kaku Axelrod book. And the subtitle is The Pentagon's Secret War Plans, Nuclear War Plans.
And this was published back in 1987?
Yeah, South End Press.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard book to get. You're better off trying to get a used one. I had to spend $30 getting my copy. It got very little attention. It had a short press run. It was pretty counterintuitive to say that the U.S. was going to do this, but they document it really well. And I want to add one thing, if I have time.
Mm-hmm.
That we're told that the U.S. created the Manhattan Project and built the bomb because we wanted to make sure the Germans didn't get it first. However, if that were really the reason, the U.S. should have been really scared the Germans would do it, because they had Heisenberg, who was like the next most famous physicist after Einstein. He surely knew how to make it. And they would have invited the crack Russian physicists to come and help. I mean, if that was their real concern, that Germany would get it first, they would have hired every damn super scientist that the Russians had to help them get it. And they would have gotten it faster, probably gotten it in time to use it on Germany. But I don't think that was their real purpose. I think they really were thinking of Russia and the end of the war, because they already were beating by 44 and 45. They already were that, you know, you could predict the end for Germany and certainly for Japan. So it doesn't make sense that they kept the Russians out of the loop.
Boy, well, anyway, this is a little known story that deserves to be better known. And we've been talking with Dave Lindorf, investigative reporter, and he has a website called This Can't Be Happening. So, Dave Lindorf, thank you very much for filling us in on this very important story.
And thank you for having me on. Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, that wraps up Fight the Empire, this, like I said, this is an amazing story. It's sort of it kind of sets a background of what, you know, this fixation that the U.S. has with Russia now. It's not, Russia is no longer a communist country, so you don't have that excuse anymore. But the U.S. still seems to have a fixation with doing something bad to the Russians. So thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the Heather McCoy Show.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 10 o'clock. Coming up next is the Heather McCoy Show.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
Give me an F! Give me a U! No! Give me a C!
Tune in August 16th from noon till 4 p.m. for KBOO's Celebration of